I've heard your name pronounced a couple of different ways. Would you tell me the way you pronounce it?
Obertäufer.
Obertäufer. A German name?
T-E-U is boy. Toy.
That's the way I would have pronounced it from my knowledge of German.
Yes.
You said you're 83?
82.
82. Okay. Well, you're just a little bit older than I am. Would you fill in a little background for me, how long you've lived in this area, for example, and education, and anything else do you think might be pertinent?
I was a public school teacher in Portland for 32 years. Uh-huh. And during the latter half, at least, of that 32 years, my wife, who was a consummate outdoors woman, and I came to this area every couple of years, and the more we came here, the better we liked it as a possible place to retire, because we were both heavily into natural beauty. We had climbed all the major peaks in Oregon and Washington, climbed some in Wyoming, climbed some in Mexico. We were climbers and fishermen and hunters. This area offered everything, and it offered a dilution of population, which we liked. We were getting a little bit troubled with the size of Portland. And so we looked for a place here to retire, and bought a place out here east of Elgin, bought the property in 74, and worked on it all summer, every summer thereafter until 79, when I retired on it, and she retired on it in 80. And it was an old, worn-out ranch. Pretty much everything had been done wrong on it. So it was a challenge to me, because I had taught biology and I had conservation ethics all through my body. I had a lot of fun working that ranch back up to what I thought it should be, the forests and the grassland and the water and the buildings which we had to use, live in. We had an old log cabin on the place which was terrible, and we made that livable, and so on. We had students that came there and helped us in the summertime for several summers, and ultimately I hired people to live with us the year round and help us, and we were there until my body began to weaken and I could no longer work the place the way I wanted to. I had the place to work in. I didn't want to sit on the front porch and watch somebody else work it. I just faced the next stage of my life and became a city feller and moved in here.
And you sold the ranch?
No. We had no one in either family that was interested in the ranch and what to do with it, particularly the forest land. I had spent years developing the forest land into a sustainable forest by using single tree management. I had a lot of different types of forest on the property. There were a lot of organizations like Nature Conservancy and Boy Scouts and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who would like to have been gifted the ranch, but they would have just sold it, rightfully so, to get the money out of it. And the person that bought it would have clear-cut that forest, and that would have cut my heart out. So, what to do with it?
How many acres? Several hundred?
At 240 acres. Uh-huh. About 80 of it was cleared land. And so our extension forester, whom I had, now I know what I wanted to tell Brett here a few minutes ago, I had pestered our extension forester for several years to bring the Master Woodland Program over here from the west side. You know what the Master Woodland Program is?
No, I don't. Tell me.
You know what the Master Gardener Program
yes.
is? Most people do. There's a Master Woodland Program that's patterned right after the Master Gardener Program, where you take about 80 hours of training from, whether it's Washington or Oregon, from your agricultural college. You take about 80 hours of training in how to, and then you give back to your extension people that 80 hours plus whatever you want to give. I gave about 200 hours and quit counting. I enjoyed it immensely. What I wanted to do was to find, I wanted to pick the brains of all those foresters down there at Corvallis that they brought out here to talk to us, to teach us. We had indoor training sessions and then field trips. And, you know, when I first got my ranch, I started taking all the field trips that I could get in on, and, you know, with Forest Service and whoever else. And I was a reader, having been a teacher, and I was grabbing for everything I could about how to manage forest lands, soils, water, all of the creatures that live in the forest.
Were you thinking of this as a demonstration project?
Yes, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And I used it for that. Mm-hmm. When I took people out there on field trips, I would tell them that the most important organisms in that forest they would not see because they were under their feet.
Yeah.
And I would explain that and what those organisms meant to the timber, particularly. You know, and I all kinds of things. I can't, you don't want me to give it all to you. But.
Well, it certainly helps to understand your involvement in other projects around here.
Yeah. And so I've been involved in everything that the Forest Service did and that the private people did, and small private people and large private folks like Boise Cascade. And, you know, I just, when anything about forests has come up or is in the paper or whatnot, I'm immediately interested. That's been my thing.
Yeah.
And I've traveled as far north as Vancouver Island and as far south as Northern California. You know, Collins Pine, you watch OPB much?
Mm-hmm.
Collins Pine runs one of those little advertisements, yeah. so to speak, before or after programs, mm-hmm. saying that Collins Pine, and they use the same line all the time. For years now they've used it, and I just love it. Collins Pine is interested in improving the life of people in Oregon. That, from one of the largest commercial operations we have in forestry. I went clear down to Northern California to see their oldest commercial operation, to see how they were doing it. They're the only, still to this day, they're the only commercial operation that uses what I was using out here on my 240 acres, single tree selection, cutting a tree when it's right to be cut. Don't pay attention to what else, you know.
Does that involve considerably more cost? Does that make the timber growing more expensive that way?
No, it doesn't make timber growing any more expensive. It may take a little bit more cost in terms of harvesting.
Well, that's what I meant. The commercial timber operation, does it have a higher overhead by doing that?
Yes,
uh-huh.
somewhat. And you have to have that tree or those trees of that kind
yep.
followed through the mill so that where you get the cost back is from the customers, and there are more and more of them that want lumber from forests that they know are sustainably managed.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got to have an end man, so to speak, that can guarantee that to the customer. But the end man It's got to have a chain of, what do they call it, a chain of something other, clear on back to the forest that guarantees that. You know, he's got to be able to follow that tree, so to speak.
You were using the term certification before. Is that involved in what you're talking about now?
Usually. Yes, usually.
And you said that the agency that does the certifying has to be completely independent and separate from whatever it is they're certifying.
Yeah, there's this... the people in New England that are producing mostly pulp started out certifying their own operations. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, my operation is good.
Yes.
You know, all the hazards involved.
Fox guarding the chicken house?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Uh-huh. And that's who certified Boise Cascade here and in the Northwest, wherever they're being certified. There are two organizations in the United States, maybe three now, that are completely independent of any producer who certify. And it costs you to have your land certified, your operation certified. But they're by far desirable, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned.
What sort of people are qualified to do that work?
Foresters, soil scientists, even sociologists that come in and study the community in which your mill and your operation operates.
And are the certifiers certified?
It's a good question.
Can you just go out and claim that you're capable of doing that?
The organization for which they work certifies their work.
Would that be like an independent engineering company?
Mm-hmm.
Architect company, something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. And you're confident that they can do a good job, at least the ones you know about?
Yes, from what I've seen of what they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And the Collins Timber Company hires such people?
Periodically they come in. That's a part of it. The initial certification is the expensive one, because they haven't seen your land, they haven't seen your operation, and so forth. And they may spend, they may have a team of three or four people come in and spend as much as a week looking at you. Well, you know, if they're high-priced people, that costs you some money. Collins Pine's got thousands of acres. Then they come back and recertify you, just give you a quick look to see if you're doing what you said you were doing, about every 3 years or every 5 years. I've forgotten what it is.
Now, I think I interrupted you or sidetracked you from what you were saying about what happened to the acreage that you had out near Elgin after you decided that you couldn't operate it anymore.
Well, we were really puzzled about what to do with it for a short time. And our extension agent over here, Paul Esther, who had headed up the Master Woodland program that I had graduated from, you know, put the idea into my head, did you ever think of donating it to the College of Forestry at Corvallis? He's a graduate down there. I'm a graduate down there, not in the College of Forestry. I put in 6 years down there in agriculture and teaching. But I knew that I knew Oregon State very well. And all the time that my wife and I, she was a graduate also at Oregon State, all the time that my wife and I had been at Oregon State, their College of Forestry had a sort of a cut and run reputation.
Like clear cutting?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And clear cutting was the thing that I was most opposed to, you know. And so the dean of the College of Forestry down there was back here attending a meeting on this college campus, and we invited him to lunch with us, just the three of us. And my wife, who's now passed away, was very incisive with her questioning. She didn't mind asking anybody anything. She was a counselor for her last 22 years in school, and she knew right where you were, and she knew how to get into your head.
Uh-huh.
And she sat across the table from George Brown and just drilled him. A word that sounds like that, but anyway, really got into him about what they might do with that property if we gave it to them. Because she was skeptical about giving it to them. When we got back home and she had a chance to talk to me about the meeting with George, she was satisfied that it was okay to give it to him.
What were they proposing to do with it?
Keep it for education and research. And we're both we spent our lives at it. She taught for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we're both educators, professional educators. Enjoyed it very much, loved education. And, you know, I was into research because I taught science, biology. And I thoroughly understood the need of research. And so we wrote up a piece of paper to give them the property, which in effect said that we wanted it used for education and research in perpetuity. The college lawyers would not accept the term perpetuity because it can't be defined. You know, how long is perpetuity? So we let that go.
Did they also commit to spending a certain amount of money to do this?
No.
That must have been alarming.
Yeah. I had the pleasure, they just changed deans of the School of Forestry down there last year. And this past summer, the new dean, who had spent, I don't know, 20, 25 years with the U.S. Forest Service, and had his last job had been the head of the research station for the Forest Service up in Montana. So he had a lot of understanding of the need of research and the value of research and so forth. I had the real distinct pleasure of walking my ex-forest out there with him and his wife and extension forester, and I heard him say everything that I wanted him to say about what they would do with that property for the next 100 to 200 years. Could have been better.
Now, how long ago was it that they took over the operation?
About 6 years ago.
Uh-huh. And are they living up to their commitments?
Yes. What they did, they are. They're not doing everything I would like them to do, but they never will, and I didn't expect them to. Right away in the first year, they put a team on the property to check out everything that was on the property and put it on computer so they know what they started with.
An inventory of every tree and building?
Practically.
Uh-huh.
No buildings. I didn't give them any buildings.
Oh.
I gave them 113 acres of our best timberland in a block. We had a couple of other small blocks of timber and then a bunch of farmland and buildings, which 127 acres of that, which we sold to an elderly couple from Idaho who are still living out there and doing a great job of taking care of it. They wanted to take care of it as we were taking care of it. They're people that love the land as we loved it. So we were very happy with that part of the sale. 113 acres was what the college got, and the College of Forestry, and And as you said a minute ago, they made a complete inventory of what they started with, which is very important. And since then, they have done a little bit of harvesting of insect-damaged trees, insect-killed trees. Other than that, they haven't done much. There's some harvesting out there that I wish they would do. They don't understand yet the need of harvesting every couple of years. As a friend of mine who's one of the best foresters I know of over in Wallowa County, who harvests every year, he says that if you don't harvest every year, you're losing some board footage off of a tree that should have been harvested last year. He's that good of a forester. He sees trees that are being suppressed by some tree that's too close to them. Well, there's quite a bit of that out there on my property, but they are not eco-foresters yet.
Have they done anything to truly make it a demonstration forest?
They're using... They're using it as a demonstration forest for teacher training classes from the university here at Eastern. And I don't know whether they're taking high school classes out there or not, like I did. I haven't been able to, you know, do everything I wanted to do in terms of keeping track of what's going on out there. I know that they're planning a trail, a foot trail, or there you can access the whole place by a minimum of roads and a minimum of skid trails, if you know where they are. But they're planning a foot trail around through the best of what they would like to show people. That has not been started yet. They want a foot trail that is gravel and so on, and has signs where people can stop and this is what you're seeing and this is the background of it and this is what we hope it to be. So, you know, but it takes a while to develop that sort of thing.
Have they given it a name?
Yes, they have a large sign larger than that doorway there that tipped up this way. The Oberteufer Research and Education Forest.
Okay. I was hoping that was so.
It's a beautiful big sign, wooden and carved and painted, you know, and managed by the OSU School of Forestry, and how to get access to it if you want.
Are they writing reports?
I'm sure they are.
You haven't seen them?
No.
They should, shouldn't they?
I've had a wife that not long after we got to town became an Alzheimer's patient. And I had all of that to take care of, eventually putting her into a home for Alzheimer's, where she died in February of 2000. And I hit bottom because I had been married for 58 years. That's a lifetime.
Yes.
And I didn't want to live until, people like Jane and other citizens around here were taking care of me off and on, and I was on Meals on Wheels and things of that kind, but there wasn't anybody there at night. Mm-hmm. I was living by myself, and I was getting some psychiatric help and so on, but my life didn't turn around until the right woman came along and started giving me love, and love conquers everything.
So
we got married last April.
I see. So along with that, have your interests expanded?
I'm back on board now to the point where my current wife wants me to start tomorrow and I would be ready to start tomorrow if I didn't have to drive tonight to Portland to a family funeral of my wife's tomorrow, and then come back. But the materials are all out and ready for me to start writing my memoirs. She wants me to be sure and write those. And I have abundant materials,
Jim. Yeah, you do.
Yeah. I've got journals and journals and letters and God knows, you know, big job of sorting it out and putting it together and making sense out of it. And all I want to write the memoirs for is initially for my own benefit, because I want to have a ball writing them, and I'm going to make enough copies to give them to members of our two families that are interested, but I'm not interested in publishing them, unless somebody makes me interested in that.
I suspect, though, that portions of your memoirs will deal with matters that are of wider interest, not just personal things.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you could publish those portions.
Yeah, my memoirs are going to wind up in umpteen volumes. My wife and I traveled around the world in 70-71 on a sabbatical. And that changed our lives, both of us. We visited 27 different countries. And, you know, I have no doubt in my mind, for instance, that what the bombing of the World Trade Center was just our chickens coming home to roost.
I think a lot of us understand that.
I think it's more and more people are getting it into their writing.
It's a common, fairly common idea now.
Yeah.
But
not common enough yet.
How exactly did you get involved with people who are interested in trying to preserve Hell's Canyon?
Can I mention one thing?
Yes.
By the way, I talked to Rick because Brett was just wanting to absolutely make sure that there wasn't anything specific that Rick wanted Bill to say to you, Eugene.
Yes.
And he said, no, there's nothing specific to Bill except that.
Okay. So we're not going to talk about Hell's Canyon specifically, although what's going on with Hell's Canyon is probably related in many ways to your somewhat more localized interests, I suspect. So let's turn to the Forest Service. What kinds of dealings have you had with them?
Well, I've been out on all of the show me trips that I could get on, particularly when they had bigwigs from Washington along, you know, the local ranger district would be hosting some bigwig out here. And I just love to go along and listen to the bigwigs and in my own mind sort out the difference between what the bigwigs are saying we would like to do or what we are doing and what the local people are doing and what the local people would like to do, which is prevented by what the bigwigs are saying.
Now, by the bigwigs, do you mean the agency heads, for example?
Agency heads, yeah. See, there's four things there. There's the agency heads that are saying this is what we're doing, mm-hmm. and the agency heads that are saying this is what we would like to do, and the locals that are bound by what the agency heads are letting them do.
Right.
And the locals that I know personally who would like to be doing things differently.
There's plenty of conflict there.
A lot of conflict.
Yeah.
And I developed a close enough relationship with the district ranger out here who was here for quite a while so that you're taping this now, aren't you? I don't know whether to say some things or not.
Well,
turn it off for a minute.
All right.
You know, there was a job coming up to head up a demonstration area here in this forest and the Umatilla Forest, promoted by the region or by the national, I don't know. And I knew that this demonstration forest was, I read everything that comes out. And I knew that they were going to select a director for it. And just by chance, I stopped in to Bob's office one day to see him, just because I was going by. And I said, "Bob, tell me about this demonstration forest. What's the progress of it?" He rolls out a bunch of maps and so on, tells me all about it. And I said, "You've applied for the directorship of it, haven't you?" And he got up from his desk, and we're sitting in a little office, and he went over and he closed the door to his little office, shut off the conversation from the, turn it off for just a minute.
Okay.
I don't like this. Okay.
All right.
What do you want to know next?
Well, where was this demonstration forest that you were just speaking about? Where is it?
It's in parts of the Whitman Forest,
I see,
which surrounds us here, and the Umatilla Forest, which is directly northwest of us.
And who established those forests? The government or?
Oh, those forests have been there for years and years and years, Gene.
Well, were they originally established as part of the Forest Service province?
Oh, yeah.
I see.
I mean, I don't know. They've been around for 100 years.
Well, that sounds as though it was a fairly enlightened policy of that at that time.
Probably the reason for it is, do you know about the Upper Columbia River study that was done by the Forest Service and other agencies, BLM and Fish and Game and so on? They did an Upper Columbia River study of the forests and grasslands of the entire Columbia River drainage from, let's say, the Cascades East, which, you know, goes clear up into Montana and clear over into Idaho, parts of it. That study went on for about 4 or 5 years. Their headquarters were over in Walla Walla. And the forest supervisor of the Umatilla Forest, whom I know very well, a great guy, and a fellow from the Forest Service Research Station here in La Grande were the joint directors of that study. The study was the brainchild of Jack Thomas. You know who he
is. Yes.
And they did an awful lot of work, and they published a lot of stuff. And I kept up with them for a while, but I couldn't. You know, I've had too many personal things in the way. And but this demonstration area is an outgrowth of that. That's all I can say now.
Is it your, you started earlier talking about all of the different levels of conflict and types of conflict within the Forest Service. What were some of your dealings with parts of the Forest Service that gave you doubts or made you question what they do?
Well, when you say dealings, I don't know what you mean.
Well, I'm getting the impression that you've had opportunities to observe both directly and indirectly what the Forest Service policies are and how these policies are carried out. So among these observations that you've made by one means or another.
Observations.
All right. What are some of the reasons that you have had doubts about what they do?
Well, they have a lot of doubts about what they do. Between the researchers mm-hmm. and what goes on the ground. There's a big time lag, as you must know. What's your experience? You're in English.
I've been an English teacher, but yeah. I've also hiked a lot outdoors, and I'm a member of several organizations that are
Sierra
involved
Club.
With preservation of the environment, so I'm tuned into it, but I don't have vast direct experience.
Okay, there's a big lag time between what research thinks they find out and what gets used mm-hmm. in medicine and natural resource management and everything. And so I've seen a big lag time between how to use fire in the woods, you know. There's some of them that think that you have to use fire as a tool. Well, in a small forest like I had, I couldn't afford to use fire as a tool because I couldn't be sure that I could control the fire enough. And the insurance payments I couldn't afford. And my neighbors could sue me if the fire got away from me.
Sure.
That sort of thing. And they would take me out and show me where they had used fire successfully, but I could take them out and show them where they had unsuccessfully used fire. But they don't show you those things. Okay? See, this is my observation. Mm-hmm. On Forest Service land. And as soon as I would mention a place where, oh yes, yes, I remember that. And they'd tell you why the fire got away from them. So, there's problems with fire. You know about the big fires back in Yellowstone.
Yeah.
And our fish and game people went back there to see the results of the Yellowstone fire immediately. Came back here and said, boy, that's just what that forest needed. But there's still people like my sister who visited Yellowstone this summer, 6 years after that fire, that are complaining about all of those blackened tree stumps and so on, because she's not with it. She's not a forester. She's an average person from the city of Portland. She doesn't know anything about it. She's an antique dealer.
She wants the forest to look pretty, I suppose.
Exactly.
Yeah, sure.
That's where most everybody yeah. is.
The way it looks in those colored photos in the calendars.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's one place where I've observed, you know, problems. And of course, the cutting. I worked on trying to get a no clear cut initiative on the Oregon ballot about 4 or 5 years ago. And we didn't make it. We didn't get enough signatures. And everybody under the sun was against us. I mean, the industry, which gets so much of their crop off of Forest Service land, just they can dump all kinds of money in there against us. Something of that kind, you know. And
both the timber harvesters and the grazing people.
Oh yes. They're having the same problem up on Vancouver Island. I was up there looking at it this summer. clear cutting destroys the forest. It destroys most of the underground creatures for a period of time. It takes quite a long while for the underground creatures to come back. It doesn't take anywhere near as long for the grasses and herbs to come back, and right away the deer and the elk are on them. We're learning a lot of lessons from the St. Helens debacle about forestry. And, of course, Kronzellerbach planted all their land, which was vastly destroyed up there on St. Helens, on the west side particularly. So if you want to plant it, and if you want a monoculture, which a good forest is not, you know, there's lots of questions. And planting a forest takes a lot of money. A good forest like I had and like Collins Pine has never has to be planted. The forest replants itself.
Back to Collins Pine.
And that's where you save money.
You said that you consider them the most enlightened timber company that you know about.
Yes.
Why is not their example more powerful for other timber companies?
Well, they want their money now.
And Collins is somehow a little more patient about their financial return?
They're looking at the long haul. Grandfather Collins, I'll call him, because he was the guy that started it, was a member of my father's board of directors in Portland. My father was in professional Boy Scouting in Portland for 40 years. And Collins was one of my dad's board of directors. And he's the guy that started his family down this line of forest land forever. And he saw, all it has to do is to come out of one man's mind who's got enough power to have it done. He saw that this is the way that you had to manage your forest. You had to manage it the way nature manages it. And take off what is your share.
And the Weyerhausers and the Kronzellerbachs don't have that that vision?
No.
Are we not coming to a time, though, when even people who are mostly concerned about money can see that the resource may not be inexhaustible?
I think so.
What else needs to be done to help them see that?
Situation in Afghanistan, you know. Complete error going into Afghanistan. Complete, utterly complete. All we're doing is creating more terrorists.
Do you see any legal remedies on the horizon for these matters of protecting forests and operating forests correctly?
If we want sustainability, then we will know what to do in terms of managing the forests and the grasslands and most important, the water. Water is where the pinch is going to come on our society first.
Mm-hmm. We're seeing that already.
Yeah, and energy, you know. All this trouble in the Middle East is because we won't control the manufacture of SUVs. We won't control how many cars each family has. Problem up on the North Slope, you know, is a drop in the bucket. Won't help us for very long. But the boys back there in particularly the White House, but also the Congress, because the White House can't do too much without Congress's okay. They are not seeing nature as their guide. reason we're, I think the reason that we are in the strongest position in the world right now is because of the piece of real estate that we inherited. And we didn't inherit it, we stole it from the native peoples. But we've got everything here that we need for a while, but it's running out.
If you were teaching again, how would you think you could convey these ideas best to young people?
Just as I'm conveying them to you.
Okay. And when you were teaching, did you find that they were listening to these ideas?
Yes.
But as adults, somehow these ideas got buried, or they found other more pressing needs, or what they thought were needs?
Some of them have come back to me, Gene, and told me what they liked about what I was teaching.
Yes.
I've got letters at home, beautiful letters, from my ex-students. When the first edition of the Population Bomb, you remember the book?
Paul Ehrlich,
Paul and Ann Ehrlich.
Yes.
When that first book came out, I bought 30 copies of it because my school would not put it in the library. I bought 30 paperback copies of it and put it in my classroom, and every kid had to read it and report on it. That's how strongly I felt about it. And I still feel very strongly about population because I believe that it's way down underneath everything else.
Well, it's also attitudes toward what the appropriate standard of living is for most Americans.
You got
it. And advertising keeps feeding ideas that are very harmful in that respect.
Buying stuff,
yes,
for Christmas.
Right.
We're seeing it in the papers,
sure.
And now it just makes me sick. Buying stuff that we don't need.
This notion that there's a direct one-on-one relationship between how much stuff you have and how happy you are.
Bullshit.
Yes.
Bullshit.
It is.
You can edit that out.
What's a little bullshit among friends?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can begin to see where I am.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, I'm in your corner. I have a son who's very much, who is avid about these ideas. He will talk at exhausting length about these matters. So,
well, I joined the Sierra Club years ago because I don't do anything with the Sierra Club. I read all their stuff avidly. But I know that every organization like that needs to be able to say, we have so many members. That's
sure.
The first reason why I joined them.
Same with Nature Conservancy.
I belong to them for a lifetime.
Wilderness Society.
My wife wrote an article which was published in the Living Wilderness.
How much writing have you done about these ideas?
Not much.
And was that because you thought you didn't have time?
I haven't been a writer. I've been a talker and a doer. And I've written a lot of letters to the editor. And I've saved every one of them. One thing I hope to do is to paste them all together and make a book of my letters to the editor.
Well, they do influence opinion.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to do.
Well, you know, I haven't written articles. My wife was an English and math major and ultimately became a counselor because that's what she became most interested in as far as kids were concerned. She counseled seniors mostly in high school and had the belief that there was, and that she was in a school where 80% of the kids went on to college or university, and she had a belief that there was a right place for every kid, not where their dad went to school, like you hear so much of, you know. But she studied colleges and universities all over this continent and tried to get kids into the right place. She had her fingers on all of the aids that kids could get at colleges here and there and everywhere, and she wanted to get the kid into the right place. She worked hard at that.
When it comes to trying to change the attitudes of people who may not go to college, or if they do, don't get exposed to ideas related to the conservation of resources, do you have some ideas about how to reach such people, what the great unwashed, the people who have bought into the media idea that consuming is the route to happiness?
No, I don't know how to get them to read the right stuff.
Do we need to arrange somehow to get them in small groups out to your demonstration forest and
yes,
give them lunch, but and explain to them in a way they can understand what the principles are of making this a sustainable forest?
Mm-hmm. We do.
Many of these people, I think, need a personal confrontation or a personal hands-on, as we say, experience with ideas like this, because they don't, the abstractions often aren't very compelling.
See, I started something last night that is related to this. You'll see the relationship. We've been working with a peace group here ever since a couple of months. And I wanted to get people to discuss these things. And so I extended an invitation to people to come to our home every Wednesday night in December, four Wednesday nights, just for discussion, open discussion. Talk about anything that was on their minds. Listen to other people, so on. Open discussion. I would not be the leader. There was no agenda. And I've got a little system for keeping people discussing and not giving speeches. And I've got a little system for cutting out side conversations, one-on-one, going to the kitchen and so on, that kind of stuff. It's using what's called an Indian talking stick. Did you ever hear of that?
I think so.
Okay, mm-hmm. You know how it works. I got four people last night. The two of us and two others. The four of us had a discussion. How do I get people to my home? I'm working on that right now. I've got three more Wednesday nights. I don't want to waste them. I had a circle of chairs in my home, all backed up the circle of chairs to accommodate about 15 people. I got four. You see how this is related to what you're just talking about?
How do you extend the invitation?
Through email and through personal invitations.
People you know or don't know?
No. People that I know.
I see.
No, I'm not going to put it in the newspaper. I don't know what I'd get. Maybe I should. What do you think?
Well, it's a bit chancy, especially if they know something, well, know that you might have ideas that are troublesome to some people.
There are people that read my, well, I've been writing letters to the editor.
I know.
You know.
Yes, I know.
You've been talking.
No, I observe too.
Oh, okay, there's people that know me.
Yeah.
And that know that I'm somewhat of a radical.
Yeah. according
what,
to...
What's a better name for that?
A leading edge thinker.
Yeah, thank you. He's good. I like him. A leading edge thinker. Well, you know, I've had pretty much of a parade of articles in the Observer over the last several years, and I have friends here in town that tell me, that have told me, that they go down the letters to the editor and read the names of who has written them.
Oh, yes.
And when they find my name, they read the letter.
Sure. And when they find Mona Charon, they don't read her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know how that works.
Well, I'm hesitant to extend an invitation in the paper.
Well, I guess what you need is something like a phone tree.
Yeah.
Getting some of the people that you know to call other people they know to invite them in.
Mm-hmm. That's
that would be a safe procedure, I should think.
Yeah.
So this is your little contribution to at least spreading some capacity to think about important questions. Does everybody who comes pretty much understand we're not going to talk about local gossip or anything like that? We're going to talk about larger matters?
Yes.
Yeah. That would be important. Do you try to summarize or record anything that's said? Or it's just for the people to experience a discussion of ideas on the spot?
It's what they receive down here.
Yeah, sure.
You know. Mm-hmm. And I'll say at the beginning that we're going to close this off at 9 o'clock. Mm-hmm. No summary. Come back next week if you liked it.
Uh-huh. I should think that would give you some sense of contributing, accomplishing something, rather than the feeling of hopelessness.
Oh, I'll enjoy it very much. Yeah. I'll enjoy it very much because I've been in a lot of discussions of that kind. Controlled in that way, and I like it very much, and I have been fortunate enough to be in a couple of organizations where they do business by consensus, which means that you've got to have a wide-ranging discussion, mm-hmm. and where the chair is smart enough to know who wants to throw something in over here, or who wants to throw something in over there.
Of course, have to have an atmosphere where people aren't afraid to say things that might be shocking.
You got to start out with that.
Yeah.
You got to start out with that.
Mm-hmm. Fish and Wildlife, have you dealt with that agency?
Not much.
Do you think that...
A couple of individuals, but very little.
So you don't have any reason to have any more or less...
You talking about the state Fish and Wildlife or federal?
Both.
Federal, I have no experience with the state, just a little.
I guess I was thinking about the connection between maintaining of salmon populations and forest practices and grazing practices. That's where they seem to come together. You haven't had any... reasons to observe what's going on there?
They're improving a few of our streams so that salmon are returning. But the Fish and Game Commission doesn't do that. They consult with the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm.
They work as a team. They work as a team with private landowners.
I guess I'm trying to figure out where you stand now, and maybe you don't have a clear-cut position on this, as to the overall efficacy of governmental agencies in doing what needs to be done to preserve our resources. Is it tipping mostly toward doing the right things, or still below that?
I'm thinking about what my... emergency room doctor asks me every time I wind up in the emergency room. He says, now on the scale of 1 to 10,
yes.
How's your pain?
Yes.
You know, you've gotten that.
Oh, sure. That's common now.
Okay. Well, 10 is a severe pain, and one is, or zero is, you know, why are you in here? And if I rate what the feds are doing in relation to natural resource management, that's just about as hard as rating my pain, you know. But there's an awful lot the feds ought to be doing that they're not doing.
Oh, are you tipping toward optimistic or pessimistic right now, then?
I guess I'm optimistic. I see them moving in the direction that I'd like them to move.
And is this at mostly the lower everyday working level, or are you talking about the upper echelon level too?
I'm talking about the working level.
Okay.
I don't think the upper echelon understands yet.
And they don't understand because they're, what, subject to the political and economic pressure of large corporations?
Exactly. They're subject to politics.
Yeah, and the lobbying. They do tend to call the shots, it seems, on many issues.
It's the guys on the ground that know what needs to be done.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you turn them loose and let them do it, we'd be all right.
Does more need to be done to make ordinary people aware of what the people you're talking about are doing?
Yes.
How could we do that?
Take them out on field trips and show them.
Yes. But it's going to take a long time to get them all out to your forest.
Yeah.
So what
else?
Well,
there's a lot of show me trips being done, but you know, that many people compared to that many people that need to be out there.
Right.
And articles in the newspaper, feature articles in the newspaper, a lot of them are pretty good, but I don't know who reads them. I read them because of what they're about.
Yeah. Well, it seems that most people read what they already agree with.
Yeah. Right.
You said your father was active in Boy Scouts. What do you see, or do you have any opportunity to see now what present Boy Scouting activities are that may be helping in this cause?